Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform, where I interview military veterans about their civilian career. Today is episode 29 with Eric Holberg.
We went out to lunch. He's like, well, what do you want to do? And I told him, well, I can do anything. And he looked at me, he's like, that's the worst possible answer you can give. And I was taken aback, and he was absolutely right. You know, I was under the impression that there's this war for talent out there, and everybody is trying to recognize talented individuals. My experience was that companies are looking for a round peg to fit into a round hole, and it doesn't really matter how awesome the peg is. If it doesn't fit exactly, they're not interested. Companies aren't interested in what you can do. They aren't interested in what you want to do and whether or not you can demonstrate that you can do that for them. And it doesn't matter how valuable a jack of all trades is, because they are. A Swiss Army knife is incredible valuable thing, but that doesn't help you get your foot in the door.
The top four reasons to listen to today's episode. First of all, Eric talks about using your shore tour to get an advanced degree and figure out your transition plan. Second, finance, Bank of America, the role of the strategy analyst. Eric provides a great in-depth look at what that world looks like. Third, consulting, breaking in from the outside. While most top-tier consulting companies hire predominantly from top-tier universities, MBA programs, and PhD programs, Eric did nearly the impossible by breaking in from the outside, and he did it through a lot of hard work. He shares the specifics on what he did to achieve the seemingly impossible. And four, consulting, Eric provides an incredibly granular and detailed look at the day-to-day life of a consultant at a top-tier consulting company, the Boston Consulting Group. Here is my interview with Eric Holberg. So my guest today is Eric Holberg. Quick background on Eric. He's a consultant at the Boston Consulting Group in their Atlanta office. He started out at the Naval Academy, where he graduated with a Bachelor of Science in History. Afterwards, he served for 11 years in the Navy as a pilot, wing assistant training officer, and maritime watch officer. After his transition from the military, Eric worked in the finance industry at Bank of America as a vice principal of strategy analyst. Eric holds an MBA and a Master's of Science in Industrial Systems Engineering from the University of Florida. Eric, thanks for joining me.
Hey, great to be here, Justin. I'm excited.
I guess first question I'd have for you is anything to add to the background or about your personal life you wanted people to know about you?
The one other thing, I had one other job in the Navy where I was actually an ROTC instructor at University of Florida.
Okay, so, that makes sense. That's when you picked up a couple of those master's degrees.
Yep, that's absolutely why I did it.
That's great. Awesome. Well, I guess to start off, I'd love to learn about at what point you knew you were going to leave the Navy and how you approached that decision.
Okay, so I knew pretty early on, like during my sea tour, I never went into, like when I joined the Naval Academy, I never thought I was going to be a career guy. You know, I thought, you know, I was raised where, you know, you're supposed to serve, so you would do my time and then get out. And that never really changed. But about halfway through my sea tour, I kind of made the decision that, yeah, there's definitely no way I'm going to stick around. And it's good that I kind of knew that early enough, because I was able to set myself up on the outside where, you know, the reason I took those ROTC orders, or actually I should say the reason I sought out those ROTC orders, was because I wanted to get out and I thought that I would need to go to grad school to do that.
That's great. I mean, knowing that you were going to get out, that does give it a lot of advantages in starting to lay that path. And I imagine you were able to get more value out of your time at ROTC because you knew you had to start getting your act together. You needed to start figuring things out.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the ROTC process is kind of an opaque one that, at least as a pilot, the detailers don't ever tell you about. So you needed to seek that out on your own. I did some research talking with people. It's like, hey, what's the best way I can go to grad school? And in naval aviation, it's difficult. They don't make it easy for you to do it. They don't really value it. And so I had to work to find the ROTC orders, and I was trying to get to the most competitive school that I could. You know, I kind of had my heart set on going to Wharton, but you know, none of the Philadelphia stuff was available in my time. You know, the only two strong schools on the slate for me were Florida and UCLA, and I just didn't see myself as a California kind of guy, so I didn't even put my name in the hat for that one. So I'm pretty lucky to have gotten Florida.
How did you consider that pursuing advanced degrees while still on active duty versus finishing up your time and getting out and then doing it. How did you weigh those two options?
That's a good question. I always wanted to do it while I was on active duty because I didn't want to go through the whole, I don't have an income when I get out, you know, be the person who, you know, they did as a pilot, I would have had to do about 10 years, and, you know, get out and then go without an income for 2 years. That was really my primary reason for the route that I took. And, but there's pluses and minuses to both of those routes. Doing it while you're on active duty makes it much harder to go to a top tier selective school.
Mm. It's just the financial side. I mean, most people, if they get out and go straight to grad school, that's, you know, let's call it $100,000 plus in debt without any income. And you were, I'm imagining, not only were you earning an income while on active duty, but I'm imagining the cost of education was at least, you know, somewhat reduced because you were involved at the university while you were there. So it's just financially, it's such an incredible difference.
It is. It is. The, like you said, the $100,000+ to go to grad school, you know, and that's what a lot of schools cost, you know, and then if you start adding in, you know, the living expenses while you're doing it, sure, GI Bill can help you out with that, but it's still a pretty big negative hole. And in my, I guess, opinion, I don't have data to back it up. It doesn't seem worth it mm-hmm. to go that route unless you can get into an absolutely top tier institution.
Yeah, no, I tend to agree with that. And what was life like for that shore tour? I'm just imagining you had your job, but then you were also going to school. How did that translate on a day-to-day basis? What was your life like?
Busy. It was busy. Being an ROTC instructor is not the most strenuous or stressful thing in the world. It's a little more work than I thought it would be going in, but really not too bad. But when you add on to that doing a part-time master's, and then you add on to that also doing a full-time master's. So I was a full-time professor, a full-time student, and a part-time student. And that's when we started a family also. So it's, you know, it wound up benefiting me a great deal. But it's not like it was without significant effort to do what I did.
How did you choose to do two master's degree at the same time? So I'm assuming the was the MBA the full-time master's, and then the MS in industrial and systems was the part-time?
Actually, the exact opposite.
Okay, yep.
So my rationale was I started the MBA program at UF in August of 2008. And within the first several months of my MBA, the entire financial world fell apart.
Oh, man.
And so it really dramatically changed my worldview. And then I was seeing my friends who were getting out of the Navy, the ones who, you know, 2009, 2010, these are hard times to find a job. If you think it's tough now, I mean, back then it was, there were some people who went years without finding stuff. And the friends that I had who didn't have trouble finding a job were engineers. I always kind of was a quantitative heavy person. I probably should have been an engineer at the academy, but I wasn't. And so I sought out the UF Department of Engineering and I said, you know what? I want to become an engineer. I want to do a master's here. And they said, okay, well, what did you major in? I told them history and they laughed at me. And when they got done laughing, I mean, I showed them my transcripts, you know, we're at the Naval Academy. You know, everybody takes 3 semesters of calculus, 2 semesters of physics, 2 semesters of chemistry, you know, systems engineering, double E thermo. I showed them my record in that and that I had good grades in all of those. And the conversation changed from them laughing to, okay, well, here's the prereqs you need to take before you can start the master's program. And so I did that. And, you know, that was the full-time one. The MBA was actually a part-time program because the ROTC unit was not supportive of us going to school during the day at that time.
Hmm. It's, you know, what strikes me when you talk about your experience is that, you know, on the one hand, you have the variability of the military placement where you want to go to Chicago. There's no opening in Chicago, so you're left with California or Florida. But then on the civilian side, it's very similar where I was graduating from business school at a similar time where, you know, every job seemed to collapse. And so it's just interesting that inside and outside of the military, there is so much dependent on timing and so much outside of your control that you can only, you know, do your best to kind of steer one way or another. But there is a lot of luck and timing in all of that.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The only thing you can really do is control what you can control and have yourself open to take advantage of things when the time comes.
And I guess knowing that you were going to get out while pursuing these 2 degrees, what did you find most helpful in preparing for that transition? Was it a particular class, or was it something you were doing on the side to start interviewing, or how did you make that transition as smooth as possible?
So I didn't get out actually until several years after leaving. I had about a year and a half after I left UF before I actually got out. And so I didn't, and I knew that, so I didn't put as much effort into the whole networking and transition while I was at UF that I should have. For me, the stuff that was the most effective was actually the networking, was leveraging whatever contacts I had or contacts that I could make in order to find openings or find roles in companies that I was interested in. You know, I don't know if it's a good idea to mention exact companies that I didn't wind up getting hired in, but you know, there were people in various companies that I either knew from my time at the academy or knew somebody from, you know, something else, or just frankly, you know, cold emailed them on LinkedIn. Say, hey, I see you're a Naval Academy graduate, or hey, I see you're a Navy pilot. I'm interested in this. And you know, that reaching out, that networking, and then frankly lucking into some other networking was the most important thing for me.
So, you know, it sounds like that's a regret you have from your time at UF. I'm wondering if you were to wind back the clock, or, you know, more relevantly, if someone is listening right now and they're about to go through an ROTC program like that, how would you recommend that they get the most out of that time from a networking standpoint?
Talk to everybody, especially your classmates, because your classmates are the best source of information. You know, they're people like you, and you are somewhat competing with them for jobs. But, it, you know, especially if you're a ROTC person and you're not getting out immediately afterwards, you're not in necessarily the same recruiting window as them. So talking with the people around you is incredibly powerful. I wound up getting a lot of good intel in the Navy from that. We're talking with the guys who are like me. There were at least 2 other Navy pilots with me at CENTCOM who were getting out right about the same time. And, you know, comparing our notes about, you know, what was working, what wasn't working, the types of roles that were opening up, the types of things that recruiters were pitching us, you know, really utilizing other people's experiences so you didn't have to make the mistakes on your own.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just thinking as you say that, like, not only just the information sharing, but I just think of my own friends and classmates and the number of them who found their job through someone in their network or from a friend or from someone they knew putting their resume higher up. It's the vast majority. And these are not people who are applying online or just dropping their resume in a bin. It's just, it makes a fantastic difference having someone you know who can vouch for you or who can alert you to a job opening before they even start advertising it.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And making that connection to the hiring manager. Mm-hmm. Like the way I ultimately found the role at Bank of America was networking luck. My wife's, like, several levels above her, one of the guys who's on the steering committee of her company. My wife is a brilliant engineer, so he wanted to keep her there in Jacksonville, which meant keeping me there in Jacksonville. So he was helping me find a job. None of that really wound up working out, but he mentioned it in a staff meeting one time. And one of my wife's coworkers, you know, she went up to my wife afterwards. She's like, hey, you know, my dad is, I forget his exact position, but it was like one of the senior people in the military relationship at Bank of America. She's like, is he interested in banking at all? I was like, let's make this connection.
That's incredible. And I guess you know, what did draw you to finance as you were leaving the military? You've got a couple master's degrees behind you. How did you know that you wanted to go into finance, or what was appealing about that?
I really didn't want to go into finance. And that I wanted, the ultimate reason why I went to Bank of America was because the job wasn't just a straight finance job. The job was an analytics job. It was, you know, using big data, not necessarily big data, but using data to drive solutions to improve the business, which I thought was something that was very marketable. And I had a lot of trouble going to Bank of America, to be honest. You know, this is early 2013, and if you remember, you know, they were just settling cases left and right for tens of billions of dollars for all the terrible things that they did during the housing crisis. And I was in collections, credit card collections, not mortgage, but I took some convincing in order to be able to go over there. And ultimately, I was convinced by two things. You know, first, that the role was what I wanted. The role was something where I would have the ability to make an outsized impact and using a nearly unlimited amount of data. And then they were also able to convince me that the abuses in the market didn't happen in credit card collections at Bank of America. You know, they honestly, you know, looking at the culture there, they didn't even know how that sort of stuff could happen. And that I would find a very different environment, and that I would not be pressured to do anything where I thought, you know, my integrity be in question. And they were able to successfully convince me of that. And so I took the role, and that's what I found. Like, I have nothing bad to say about the people at Bank of America and the way we treat our customers, at least in credit card collections.
Mm. And you know, especially for someone who's on active duty right now, how would you explain to them that role that you took of strategy analyst?
So a strategy analyst is kind of similar to some staff jobs you'll see on like a larger staff. And what the job ultimately was my team focused on a portion of unsecured collections. We focused on the outsourcing of unsecured collections, based 99% credit card. And what you do is you essentially manage the strategy. You are the people who, you know, dig through the data to monitor the performance, help do some projections on what you expect the performance to be, and most importantly, identify opportunities to improve the performance, build the data-based case, business case, that what you're proposing is going to generate, you know, additional income, and then implement and monitor those strategies that you come up with.
Hmm. And I think it's also helpful to kind of paint the picture of the day-to-day life. And so I'm wondering, as much as you're willing to share about like what the hours were like, how many people you worked with, if you had to travel, if you were working on weekends, just how that translated from a lifestyle and just, I guess, week in, week out basis.
Okay. Bank of America is actually a great company to work for in terms of work-life balance. They put a lot of emphasis on people liking it there. And actually treating you well. They treat their employees pretty darn well for a large employer. And so I didn't really work weekends ever. My day was 8 to 5. Some days that I stay past 5, yeah, but it typically wasn't any later than 6. I don't think I ever worked later than 6. And your average day, unfortunately, a lot of it was spent on conference calls. The group is spread around the country. So it was primarily headquartered in Delaware, but they had people in Jacksonville. They had people in Atlanta. They had people in Phoenix. They had people in LA, and so in Ohio. And so a lot of the stuff had to be done over a conference call on the phone, which wasn't the most efficient thing in the world, because when you have a conference call, it doesn't cost you anything to just add another person to the invite. But so you'll probably half of my day was spent on conference calls. The other half would be doing actual work, meaning, you know, digging through the data, coming up with ideas, then digging through the data to validate or disprove my idea, and then building a business case around the idea if it works.
Mm. I just can't even imagine the amount of data you had access to. For anyone interested in research or analyst or anything like that, I just can't even imagine how much data you could pull from. And so it sounds like some aspect of the job was just thinking of like what I mean, is it right to say you're almost coming up with hypotheses of like, hey, maybe this could be something we learn, and then finding the data to support that, and then seeing if it proves or disproves it, and seeing if there's some sort of business opportunity there? Was it kind of like this laboratory of data instead of chemicals?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Wow. It's pretty similar to consulting in that it was hypothesis-based or hypothesis-driven problem solving.
Mm. And I'm always curious to learn, when you look at those first couple years out of the military, how did you feel ahead of your civilian counterparts, and in what areas did you feel like you needed to really catch up to others?
In terms of ahead of civilian counterparts, I think that military people bring relationship building to the table, and I still think this is true in consulting. The ability to form relationships with your coworkers, people you work with directly in your team, and people you work with on a related basis. So to understand who's who in the organization, who does what, and build the relationship so that you know you can count on them and they know they can count on you. Because in the civilian world, everything is done on a team, right? So I would come up with hypotheses largely on my own. Sometimes other people would supply them to me. And the research and data-driven stuff was on my own, at least at first, before you have to combine it with somebody else's work product. So then that starts the teamwork element of it. And then you need to shepherd your idea, either your only or idea or your team's idea, through a group of approval processes, socialization processes. So building, understanding how that works and being able to build those relationships so you can call somebody on the phone and they know where you're coming from and you know where they fit into things and what the sort of questions they're going to ask you are is powerful. And I think that's where military people are typically ahead of the curve. Behind the curve, this is kind of a cop-out answer, but it's just, I would say, general business knowledge or subject matter knowledge. I knew absolutely nothing about collections before I got there. I'd thankfully never been in collections before. Anytime a debt collector called me, it was a mistake. So I had no idea what the business was like, and that took me a while to get up and going. Most of my counterparts had some knowledge of a related area before they got in there. Most of them either worked for a competitor doing the same thing, or they worked in essentially like a lower level portion of the company in the collections in the collections realm.
One question I have, and no need to answer this if you don't want to, but it just strikes me that a lot of times when talking to people on active duty, there's sometimes a misconception about earning potential once you get out. And and I'm wondering, in that very first job out of the Navy, was your salary higher than it was in the military, about the same, or was it lower?
Lower.
Okay. Yep.
Go ahead.
And I was just wondering, roughly how long did it take until you got back to your Navy salary?
Doing the reserves, I was pretty close to breaking even.
Okay.
But in terms of breaking, more than my Navy salary just in civilian employment, it took moving to consulting.
Yep.
And that was absolutely one of the factors why I moved. Yep. Rather than staying at Bank of America. A lot of large employers have policies in place limiting the size of raise you can get. And so if they have you, at a small level, they'll give you a 15% raise and think that that's astronomical. It doesn't really matter if it's 30% below market.
It's just really interesting. When you say that, it makes me realize, because a lot of the people I've interviewed, it almost feels like across the board, people took a step back in terms of pay and seniority level to get their foot in the door and work their way up. And some of the people I'm thinking of were in startups where it is much more open of an organization and they were able to rapidly rise after that. But I think that you're bringing up something for people to consider that if you enter into an industry where there are rules that restrict how quickly you can promote and how much your salary can increase, that could take a lot longer to bridge that gap from a financial standpoint.
Yeah, or you can move companies.
Yep. And you know, one thing I was going to ask, because I want to dive into consulting, but I wanted to ask about just basic career progression in a strategy analyst type of role. And when I think of consulting, I think of people who can move up in consulting and people who can jump over to maybe one of their client companies and work there. Is there what would be like the equivalent career paths for someone in strategy analyst, in a strategy analyst position?
Oh, you mean like if I'd stayed at Bank of America?
Yeah, exactly.
So that's a good question. So there, most large organizations, definitely in banking, all have strategy, strategy business units inside of, or line of business. That was the word I was looking for. They have strategy line of businesses for, you know, their you know, main components. And so you can rise up inside of that, or you can go someplace and do something different. The going someplace and doing something different, there's tons of compliance things in banking, but then moving to the kind of operational side is a little harder. You know, almost every organization can ultimately be broken up into revenue side and cost side. You're either the people who are making the money, or you're the people who are the cost of doing business. And my opinion, wrongly, but the strategy people are often considered kind of the cost of doing business and not the real revenue side. And so that makes it harder to get, you know, any sort of large raises based on that. So, you know, if I would have stayed, I was actually offered a job at Merrill, you know, which is part of Bank of America, to move over there the same day that BCG offered me. And, you know, it was a kind of a similar role, a strategy type role, implementing actually a consulting engagements recommendations. So that is probably the path that I would have taken, or the most logical path is, you know, some sort of continuing strategy role, but just in a different line of business in the bank.
And, you know, one thing I'm realizing as I have more of these conversations is how iterative the job search process is, where you're not going to get out of the military and most likely you won't take a job that you'll have the rest of your career. Almost everyone, you have a year or maybe two or three, and then you move on to the next position or industry or functional role. And that kind of repeats multiple times. And so I'm wondering, when you were at Bank of America and you knew that you wanted to switch things up, how did you approach that second job search?
that was a tough one. That honestly took a lot of soul searching, because I was doing really well at the bank. And, you know, it was acknowledged that I was doing really well at the bank, so I thought I had a future there. And when it was kind of made blatantly apparent to me that I didn't, or at least didn't on anything near the sort of timeline that I was looking for, I knew I had to do something different. And that kind of beat me up for a while. There were a couple months there where I would, you know, look at things internally and, you know, sometimes talk to people about the role and, you know, glance around a little bit at, you know, some of the competitor banks. And it took me a while to figure out what I wanted to do and it become consulting. It actually, you know, I bounced some ideas around a couple of times, and then I saw the work product that came out of a consulting engagement my organization had. And I had done some work on some cross-functional improvements, you know, things that were not specifically related to outsourcing of unsecured collections, but would involve some other resources, some other areas, all still in collections, but somewhat cross-functionally. And I was never able to get any traction for them. because I wasn't able to get them up to the level they need to be to get approved, because, you know, I was involving, you know, multiple stakeholders. And then we had a consulting engagement come in, and they asked, hey, has anybody looked into this? Yeah, Eric has. Ask him. But, hey, has anybody looked into this? Yeah, Eric has. Then, you know, I gave them, you know, my data and my findings on it. And 2 months later, I see it in their final deck.
And wait, what was that? Just wondering, when you see that, was that pride that you're feeling of like, my data was that good? Or was it that those, you know, those effing guys that took my data and they never listened to me directly? They had to hear it from someone else saying it.
Yeah, that's what it was. I was furious.
Yeah.
And then I did a little more soul searching, and it's like, you know what? You could get angry about this, or you could become a management consultant. Yeah. And, you know, there's a reason why there's so many management consultants, is because cross-functional change is hard for an organization to do. It often requires that outside perspective. And so I realized that's what I wanted to do. You know, what I wanted to do was make an impact. That's what I said in my first job search. That's what I said in my second job search. And it was true both times. You know, I essentially, through working in my first job, found out that there was a way to make a bigger impact. And that's what I did in my second job.
And I want to dive into consulting, but I'm wondering on that soul searching side, because I think that that's a common trend that comes up, is how important it is to continuously dig deeper and explore what motivates each of us and what we want, and really know, you know, what we're aiming for. Is there any advice you would give to someone about any structured way to approach that, or resources you found helpful, or books or movies, or just, I'm just trying to think of anything tangible for someone to investigate if they're trying to deepen that soul searching process?
A lot of people recommend the What Color Is Your Parachute?
Yep. Yeah.
In terms of that, I read it, but I honestly don't remember, to tell you the truth.
Yep.
Maybe it didn't resonate with me the first time. What I would say my advice, unfortunately, this isn't all that structured. I'm being a bad consultant right now. My advice would be, find what you want to do, and it better be something where you can have demonstrated talent or ability at that. You know, it's great that you want to do something, but if you can't put anything on paper as to why you're able to do that, or why somebody should take a chance on you to do it, then few people will. But if you can come up with saying like, hey, I'm really passionate about this, and I have a track record of doing related things, you know, because it's hard to get a one-to-one translation in the military, but you can, with some effort, you can, you know, have related experiences. Like for me, there's no real strategy, you know, analytics stuff in the Navy that I know of, at least. But, you know, I showed him, was like, hey, I did this project when I was at the wing about improving the efficiency of this new airport design. And, you know, then I went to CENTCOM, and I forgot, you know, what examples it was that I showed them. But, you know, it's like I gave them the path. It's like, hey, here, this is somewhat relevant experience. It's not banking, but it is process related. And this is operations related. This is data based. I can show you the improvements that we made. And that's what was able to ultimately give the guy who hired me the confidence that you're like, you know what, I will take a chance on this guy. Banking knowledge isn't that big a deal.
That's great. And I appreciate that about your LinkedIn profile, that you did take the time to translate your military experience into a way that's applicable to the jobs you've held. And I just think that's such a valuable skill, to be able to explain your past in a way that's relevant to that future career.
Yeah, it definitely helped.
And so what was that, I guess, what was it like switching over to consulting? What was that interview process like? And any advice for people pursuing a role in management consulting?
So management consulting is unlike a lot of other areas in that the recruiting process is highly defined. And it's almost exclusively based off of recruiting directly from top tier undergrad, MBA, and PhD programs. So breaking in from the outside requires networking. And the way I did it was actually through friends. I started out looking up, you know, I identified, okay, in management consulting, there's the top three firms. There's McKinsey, there's Bain, and there's BCG. And I had said, you know what, I'm shooting for the stars. I need to go top three. And so I started looking up on LinkedIn. I was like, okay, who do I know at those firms? And start reaching out to them. And having done my research beforehand about what it was they did there, you know, told them like, hey, I've seen the work that they provided. It's similar to what I do. And it's absolutely what I wanted to do. And show them that, like, I knew what was going on. And really the only thing I was looking for them was advice into, you know, getting my name in the pipeline, getting my name in the recruiting window. And at the same time, simultaneously preparing for the interviews. Management consulting is famous for the case interviews. They're incredibly difficult. They're stressful, and it's, you know, something that you can't get around. And so while I was networking with all these people trying to essentially get somebody to refer me in so I could get an interview, or at least get my name in the pipeline, I was practicing the case interview stuff. Which a case interview, for anyone who doesn't know, there's tons of material on this online, the recruiting process also. It's basically a business problem where they'll give you a business problem and, you know, you walk through a hypothesis-driven approach to solving that business problem in about 25 minutes. So it's pretty much a consulting engagement in 25 minutes or less. And there's a bit of gamesmanship that goes on with it, but it's more about making sure that you are thinking and solving the problem in a hypothesis-driven and linear and logical manner, and adequately communicating that you are doing that so that they understand what steps that you're taking. So I prepped for that. I bought a couple of books, watched some videos. I prepped for that from just about after Thanksgiving right through when I got my offer at the end of March.
Wow. Do you remember offhand any of the books that you used to prepare, or ones that you would recommend for listeners?
The one that I liked was, I think it's called Case Interview Secrets. It's by Victor Chang. That was the one that worked the best for me. I bought that, and I also had Case in Point, which Case in Point was nice too. It just, the Victor Chang's method to me seemed, it was the one that resonated with me.
That's great. I'll add that in the show notes as well for anyone interested in those. And you know, it is like you said, it does seem like for consulting, there's the most heavily trod path there is from a top tier, like exactly like you said, undergrad, MBA program, PhD program, and so breaking in from the outside. It is impressive to see the way that you approach this tactically, and you really did put in the time and effort to make that jump. And let me just skip a little bit ahead, because you had written a great article on the concept of top talent, and I'll post mm-hmm. that in the show notes as well. And I'm just wondering, as you were writing that article, other things that you would want listeners to know about top talent and breaking into organizations.
I think I put the important parts in the article. Mm-hmm. I can go over those a little bit if you want.
I'll put a link there. I would just encourage people listening to look at the show notes and find the link there to the article, because I think you laid out a really good explanation that would be worth any veteran listening to. And going back over to Boston Consulting Group, what is your day-to-day life like?
Day-to-day life, you know, can vary a great deal from one to the next. That's the thing. One of the things that people like about consulting is the variety. You know, your days are not necessarily alike. Your cases are rarely all that similar. There's a ton of variety in what sort of problems you're solving, what sort of clients you're dealing with, what level of the client, and how much interaction with the clients you have. My given day to day, we leave the hotel about 7:15, at the client site, you know, by 8:00, we work here typically till about 7:00. The work day here consists of, we'll have some team meetings. We'll discuss research. We're doing analysis. We're doing, slides we're making in as a team. we'll have meetings with clients where either we're brainstorming with them, getting data from them, showing them our findings so far and getting their reaction, to formal team meetings. And, a typical day, we'll leave the client site about 7. Sometimes we'll stop somewhere and get a quick dinner as a team. Typically once a week, we'll have like a nice dinner as a team. We'll go to a nice restaurant and stay there for an hour and a half or 2 hours. Sometimes we just go back to the hotel and eat in our rooms and get back to the hotel. Most people will take a little bit to relax and get back to work and, work from 9 to 11 or so. And then, rinse and repeat.
and I'm assuming that's kind of like Monday. Is that Monday through Thursday and then back in the home office on Friday?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So Monday morning, you're on the flight to the client site. Thursday evening, you're on your flight back, or Thursday afternoon. And then Friday, you're back in the office.
And is that a lighter day, or what's that Friday like?
I think it depends very much on which firm you're in and which office you're in. BCG's Atlanta office, it's really hard to get stuff done on Friday because you just want to talk to everybody. Everybody's so friendly. It's such an open and collegial atmosphere that it's kind of tough to get stuff done because you're trying to catch up with, with all your friends at the firm. And, we do work, obviously, on Fridays, and we have calls and we have focus rooms where you can go off to be on your own and, avoid being interrupted or just overhearing people's stories, stuff they're working on this week, stuff that happened to them on the road. But, you're also, networking is not the right word, but you're just, building a connection with these people because they're your teammates. If they're not working with you on this case, it doesn't mean they're not going to work with you on the next case. And you can learn from them about, how they're interacting with their manager, with their partners, with their project leaders. Find out some things that they've done that they found interesting that you might want to try to work on next. Get intel on, are they selling another case at their client and they're going to be looking for somebody like you in 2 weeks.
That's great. How long on, I know this is highly variable, but what's the general sense for how long cases last?
It is indeed highly variable. They used to say, the average was, 8 week case or 12 week case. I don't think there's really such a thing as an average anymore. They're, due diligence cases go very fast. Those are 3 weeks. Major transformation cases can go multi-year. At a place like BCG, you typically wouldn't stay on a case with the same client for more than 6 to 9 months, because things happen so fast. And you're expected to grow and gain a new level of experience and insight and learn how to work do different work efforts. So that you typically wouldn't stay on any longer than 6 months because at that point it's time for you to get some sort of new experience.
And how have you approached, from an outsider's perspective, I would assume that you've been there for a little over a year. And so you've had time to do a couple of cases. How have you approached your career in terms of, did you go in wanting experience with a specific industry or within a specific functional role or within a specific geography or with specific people? How did you kind of prioritize the cases that you went after?
I didn't at first. Mm-hmm. Now... I've actually only done 2 cases. They say, they don't really last longer than 6 months. Well, that's what I've done. I did a 6 month case and I'm in the process of wrapping up another case. It'll be a little over 6. It'll be more like 7 by the time I'm done in a couple weeks. My first case, they came to me, when you're brand new, you don't really know what you don't know. And they came to me and I said, yes. And then the second case, they asked me what I was looking for. And I was really just interested in personal growth. My first case wasn't much of a growth opportunity. It was pretty abnormal from that perspective. And so I said, hey, I want some place where, I want a solid team where I have the capability of growing. I want a manager who has a reputation as a people developer. And that's what they gave me. And it's worked out fantastic. We had a great team. We're kind of wrapping up now and I'm pretty sad to leave it because we've had such an awesome team room. Mm-hmm. Now that, more, I guess, mature in my consulting career, now I'm identifying specific things that I want to target. So for me, the thing I want to target next is what we call customer insight. Customer surveys, things like, you know, figuring out what a client's customers are actually looking for. BCG in the South has a reputation as being the best in the world at that. And so, you know, I'm here at BCG in the South. I got to take advantage of that. It's something that I'm interested in. And if you have the opportunity to learn it from the best in the world, you got to take advantage of that.
That's great. And I know that there's an anonymity aspect of what you're doing, but I'm wondering, mm-hmm. just those two cases you've done so far, broadly speaking, what industry or functional role, or what would be like the one sentence summary of what each of those were?
The first one I was on was called the PMO, the Project Management Organization, for a large public sector transformation. So think, you know, large government department or ministry that was what we call a transformation, where they're, you know, revising basically all of their processes, procedures, and structures to be a more modern organization. My second one now, I'm on with a large retail client. And I'm working with a client team, actually. We're doing a consulting-type problem, but I'm the only consultant on the team. And it's inventory-related. It's about improving the availability on the shelf for the customer.
It just seems that the reputation's true, that the advantage with consulting is you're able to get exposure to so many different opportunities and industries and functional roles and gain exposure, and then, as you've already started to do, start to narrow in on what types of things you want to do. And I like how you said that, where when you started out, you didn't really know what you didn't know, but in you know, 14 months, you've very, very quickly got a better sense of what you do like and don't like. And it does seem like it's an efficient way to start to get your footing and figure out what you want to do more of.
Yeah, and it's the other portion of that is exposure to senior leadership. Mm-hmm. Like my current case, I have meetings every other week with the head of supply chain for the whole company. And this is a Fortune 100 company, and you know, he's in the C-suite, and I get to meet with him. You're just me, my vice president who's running the team that I'm on, and my project leader, just the three of us up in his office for an hour every other week.
That's great. I mean, it makes me think back to your time at Bank of America, where one of the desires was to have a high impact, and the frustration was that even though you had good numbers and good advice, it just didn't penetrate that far up within the organization. And then now you're on the other side, and you're able to get just right up to the highest echelon of decision making, which is very, I imagine, very exhilarating.
It is. And I try to impress that on my teammates who've never done anything else. Like I have a teammate who came right out of undergrad. And, you know, the way I was trying to tell her was like, hey, you probably don't realize how special this place is. You know, you're in your early 20s and senior leaders at an enormous company ask you a question. You know, they ask you what you think about something and they actually listen.
That's great. And for someone who's listening right now, maybe they're on active duty or just out of the military, what would you say are signs that they may really enjoy and be well suited for consulting, and some signs that maybe this isn't the right career path for them?
So signs that this is what, if you're the type of person who is, you know, honestly, a little, you got to be an overachiever and a little almost neurotic. It's not the right word. I can't come up with the right word right now, but you know, an overachiever who, you know, constantly thinks that they're actually not doing enough is our personality traits that you find in consulting a lot. Because it's about producing a high impact, and you produce a high impact in a very short amount of time. And so you have to be incredibly conscientious about making sure that you are covering every possible detail. Because there are many, many details. The people who probably won't like this, if you don't get excited, if you've never been excited by work, if you've never had an assignment in school that's ambiguous and difficult, then this is not for you. That's what this is. Like if you're in B school, especially in B school, if you're doing case studies, and you don't really like case studies, if you don't get excited by some of the problems, you probably don't want to be here because you're not going to like it. In all honesty, you probably won't get through the interview process, but in the odd chance that you do, you're not going to be happy here.
And then, you know, looking back on when you first transitioned out of the Navy, I'm wondering what were some of the more surprising aspects about your civilian life or your civilian career that you didn't really know to expect?
That's a good question. I think really the most surprising thing to me about the transition was not anything about civilian life, but more about the move to civilian life and how, you know, I was under the impression that, you know, there's this war for talent out there and everybody is trying to recognize talented individuals and hire them into their companies, where my experience was not that. My experience was that companies are looking for a round peg to fit into a round hole, and it doesn't really matter how awesome the peg is. If it doesn't fit exactly, they're not interested. That was the part that surprised me the most.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm thinking of another conversation I had where someone was saying, yeah, veterans always try to portray themselves as the Swiss Army knife. Like, put me in, I can do anything, it doesn't matter. And how that often falls flat. And I like the way you explain that is, like, if someone is looking for that round hole to fit that round peg, they are looking exactly for the person for the job. And so if someone comes as the jack of all trades and the Swiss Army knife, it's like, nope, I don't have enough time to figure out if you'll work here. I'm just going to find the exact right fit.
That's absolutely right. And that was the guy at Bank of America. That was the advice he gave me when, you know, he asked me, we went out to lunch. He was like, well, what do you want to do? And I told him, well, I can do anything. And he looked at me, he's like, that's the worst possible answer you can give. I'm like, what? And I was taken aback, and he was absolutely right. Companies aren't interested in what you can do. They're interested in what you want to do and whether or not you can demonstrate that you can do that for them.
That's great.
And it doesn't matter how valuable the jack of all trades is, because they are. A Swiss Army knife is an incredible valuable thing. Once you get into the organization, that makes you a valuable player if you can do multiple things and handle the sort of cross-functional and ambiguous tasking that sometimes comes across. But that doesn't help you get your foot in the door.
This is great. Well, I always like to end on a more catch-all, open-ended question. And I think you've done a fantastic job of laying out the world at Bank of America and Boston Consulting Group and getting an MBA and a master's degree on active duty. I'm just wondering, for other veterans who are listening, any other advice you would want to give to them or something you want to pass on to them before we wrap up?
Really just work at it. They say finding a job is a full-time job. It absolutely is. And it's a full-time job well before you ever are actually looking. You know, preparing for the transition as far in advance as you humanly can is the right way to go. And if you don't know what you want to do, you don't have an idea how to prepare, your first step is networking. Your first step is informational interviewing. Reach out to vets. You don't have to know them. I've taken, you know, essentially cold emails from people that just reach out to me on LinkedIn. You know, I've talked to them. I don't have as much time to do that as I used to because management consulting is a lot of hours. But I still do. I've still taken calls. I've still taken emails. People want to help. And, you know, what's the worst that can happen? They ignore you. That's it. As long as you're putting in your time doing your research and not asking for a handout, people are willing to help. Just ask.
I think this is good advice for career search and probably for those who are single for online dating. It takes the same muscle of not being afraid of rejection. Well,
yep.
Eric.
Well, I met my wife online.
So. Me too.
I guess I follow through.
Well, Eric, I appreciate your time, especially knowing how crazy and chaotic your schedule is between family life and consulting life and traveling all around. Really appreciate your taking the time to speak with me.
No problem, Justin. You know, just want to help. That's why I started writing the stuff on LinkedIn in the first place.
Awesome. And I'll be sure to link to those articles as well. So thanks so much, Eric.
Surface, surface, surface.
Thanks for listening. Three quick announcements. First, if you're enjoying this podcast, it would mean a lot if you take a few minutes to leave a review on iTunes. It helps me get this work further out to the veteran community. Second, based on my interviews, I'd advise any and all veterans to look at servicetoschool.org and the American Corporate Partners. Both are completely free for veterans and give you a lot of great resources for your education or professional life, respectively. Third, there are a ton of other great interviews, resources, and data at beyondtheuniform.io. Check it out, share it with your friends, and drop me a line if you have any feedback. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks, and see you on the next interview.